I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. It's really hot today in Athens, Georgia. Hot as balls, some people say. I just got back from Aspen, where it was not as hot, but it was a lot of fun. It was the classic, the food and wine event out there that's held every June. Y'all should go sometime. It's a lot of fun. You can say hi to me. I will say hi back. Maybe there's a high five involved. Well, this is the second of three episodes that I taped on a recent trip to Los Angeles. Brooke Williamson from Playa Provisions and Playa del Rey was on last week's episode. James Beard winner Michael Cimarusti, who's the chef and owner of Providence in West Hollywood, is coming up next week. But on this episode, I visit Suzanne Goyne at her French restaurant AOC near the Beverly Center in West Hollywood. She also owns Luke's and Tavern Restaurant, and she caters performances at the Hollywood Bowl, which is fun, and something we talk about early in the episode, because I remember a lot of family history and my dad taking us to concerts there. You know, it's we recorded this in the wine room upstairs at AOC, and I just can't quite put into words how stunningly beautiful that room is. It's very wood. It's like a really like a French farmhouse, and it's covered with wine on every available spot for storage and amazing wine. So it's fun to just, yeah, I don't know, poke around. But here's this week's conversation. Suzanne Goyne pours a burgundy. I'm in Los Angeles. And what neighborhood would you classify this as?
West Hollywood. It's not really West Hollywood.
It's kind of the lower West Hollywood,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's funny. Well, it's, yeah.
That voice on the other mic is Suzanne Goyne. Which the funniest story about in my personal knowledge of you and your career is I always lauded you and thought you were so amazing in books and reading about the restaurants. But I always, on your website, you classify yourself as coming from a family of Francophiles. So long before I even read that, I convinced myself that it was Goyne. Uh-huh. It was the last name and that you were French. That's so evoked in all of what you do. I mean, we're sitting in basically a French farmhouse, which is AOC in West Hollywood, and it's so French in so many ways. But not the gilded French.
Yeah.
It's more of the rustic French.
Absolutely.
But which exudes in the food. So you've got Luke's, you've got AOC, you've got Tavern, you've got Hungry Cat with your husband, and then you've got a bakery and a catering company. How do you do all that?
We do the Hollywood Bowl, too. Do you know about that?
No, what do you do with Hollywood Bowl? Do you sing?
No, I do not sing. That you do not want to hear.
Who sings Short People? I went and saw my father.
Gary Newman.
Newman. Yeah. My dad used to take us to concerts when he taught out here, and he used to take us to the weirdest concerts. It's like that. And Emmylou Harris. I mean, which at the age of nine was be boring, but was great. So what do you guys do? All the catering?
We do the food. So we do the food.
Okay.
So there's three restaurants there.
Yeah.
And then there's also the box seats. We call it supper in your seats.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like a catering. You pre-order the day before.
Yeah.
And then we cook everything to order. It's like we sort of know what's coming, but it can be up to like 500 or 600 seats.
So a good kitchen layout there.
Yeah, good kitchen layout.
Hidden somewhere.
Deep in the bowels of the bowl. Exactly. It's all hidden.
Yeah, that's amazing that those things exist and the machinations that happen with food behind the scenes.
Yes.
That's great. Yes. So you started this restaurant that we're in 2002, but you started Luke's in 1998.
Yes.
Tell me how that started. Because you came from a background of working around L.A., you're from L.A., and I think you'd been to France to cook for a little bit.
Yeah, I went to
Northern California.
Yep, I grew up here, but then I went to college back east.
Okay.
And so I worked, actually my first serious restaurant job was actually at Ma Maison in the summer here before I left for college.
But post-Wolfgang?
Just post-Wolfgang, yeah, for that summer.
What was the vibe there after Wolfgang left?
It was actually really good. It was very, it was a lot of energy, a lot of cologne, a lot of waiters with cologne. I got thrown into the pastry kitchen.
When did waiters stop wearing cologne? I don't know.
Did the French ones stop? Did the French ones ever stop? I don't know. I don't know if they ever stopped. I just remember memory of like that's like one of the big things when I think about when I have a flash of thinking of that kitchen.
Immediately get the sensory.
The French, the cologne rushing past me. I got thrown into the pastry kitchen and I just loved it. But I was sort of already on this track to go to college, went back east to school, immediately got a job in a kitchen, and I worked at Al Forno for the, you know, the whole time I was in college.
Yeah.
And when I graduated.
Al Forno in Providence.
Al Forno in Providence.
Remind me of their names.
George Germone and Joanne Colleen.
And they were so, I mean, for the East Coast, they were so important and sort of, I remember that book. I remember particularly the fruit crostatas that they used to do that were so, I mean, so mind-bendingly simple in so many ways, but so beautiful and cared for. Yeah. And everything coming out of the oven, and then the grilled flatbreads
pizzas, and you know they were interesting to work for because they were both artists. They'd both gone to RISD, had never worked in restaurants before, had gone to Italy and fell in love with food, and sort of came back and built a restaurant kind of based on cooking at home, like how you would do everything at home. But we did everything to order. It was a great place to learn, and I remember we used to drive to Little Compton, Rhode Island, to get tomatoes, and that was kind of the first moment that I saw that type of dedication.
Wait a minute, that's how we should buy stuff.
Exactly, exactly.
And they, how long was that, is that restaurant?
It's still there.
It's still
there. Yeah, I think it's.
And you went to Brown?
I went to Brown, yeah.
I think you're the only James Beard outstanding chef in the country who was a Brown graduate. Most of them didn't graduate college.
Jody Adams is a Brown graduate too.
Jody Adams is amazing.
Yeah.
She won a Beard Award this year. Uh-huh. I was so happy to see that. Buvette is such a seminal place. It's funny, they've got three Buvettes now.
Yeah.
Paris and Tokyo. I don't know how people do that.
I don't know how people do that.
You want to do AOC Singapore?
I have trouble with like Brentwood, Hollywood, and West Hollywood.
Well, that's, I always equate LA to an amalgamation of small towns connected by a lot of traffic.
Yeah. So, yes, it's true.
So you won Best Service for Luke's, and that was in 2006. You won Best Chef California in 2006. Is that right?
No, we never won Best Service. I won Best Chef West.
Okay.
In 2006, and then I won
Outstanding Chef.
Yes.
In 2016.
16, yes.
After a trove of treasure trove of nominations.
Yeah.
Annie Quattrano, the chef at Bacchanelli in Atlanta, once told me that it's good to be nominated because when you don't win, you get nominated again. You get to go again.
Right.
And it's fun.
Well, you hope you get
nominated. And you hope. Yes, you hope. Yeah, you hope you don't just fall off the radar.
Yes, they're going to get tired of you. And although I have to say winning, it was such a relief to not go through that roller coaster,
Of anxiety.
Like,
Yeah, I think the best way to not win is to prepare a speech. Then I don't win.
Right.
And then the one time I didn't prepare a speech is when I won. It's a crazy world of the Beard Awards. But you cooked at Mama's Own, and you were at L'Orangerie.
I was L'Orangerie. Same thing, like a summer job in LA when I would come home from the summers. And I basically spent 10 years living other places. So Providence, and then I went from there to Chez Panisse.
Okay.
Worked at Chez Panisse for 2 years.
And who was the chef at Chez Panisse then?
Catherine Brandel.
Okay.
And David Tanis.
Yeah.
And actually Peggy Smith, who's Cowgirl Creamery.
Yeah.
Kind of at the, they do that very civilized thing if they have two chefs to cover the whole week.
So, right.
Yes, it's unlike anywhere else.
Yeah.
And
sometimes they did. Didn't they do the seasonal chef? Like Tanis was the chef there for like 5-6 months a year. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
But I guess if you have like 16 people in your kitchen or just working there on free stages, that you can afford
you can
to do that.
I need to figure that one out. And then I went to France for a year.
Right.
And then came back to Boston, actually. I worked for Todd English.
Okay.
And I had my first chef job was a little 28-seat place in the north end of Boston called Aloro. And then ended up coming back home and working here I worked for Nancy and Mark Peel at Campanile for 2 years.
Yeah.
Before opening Luke in 98.
What's in the Campanile space now?
Republique.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which is, talk about a carrying on of tradition. That's a great space,
exactly.
But that's Republique is a great, great restaurant too. And in France, you worked at L'Arpège for a little bit?
Yes.
Alain Passard.
Mm-hmm. Which was fantastic. And I also worked in the Southwest in a restaurant for a chef named Didier Udil.
Okay.
Little tiny town. I worked there for
what region?
6 months in the Southwest in Les Landes.
Okay.
Yep.
Do you go back to France much?
No, I need to. That whole children restaurant thing kind of interview.
Yeah, that, I found that's a bit of a shuffle and a juggle. I actually, my kids are older now, but I took them to, we rented a place and went to Burgundy and met up with a bunch of friends. It was great.
Yeah,
I mean,
great.
They're like 13 and 15 at the time.
Yeah.
And it was so relaxing in so many ways. And it's just so pure to just jump in the car and meet up with winemakers we know and cook food at this great on this great stove in this rustic farmhouse.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was great. It wasn't even that expensive. So it was really nice.
I'm planning a little trip for winter for Christmas break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
I think southwesty.
So Luke's opened up. What was the expectation? When you open up a restaurant, what did you want from it?
Things were so different then. It's amazing. I just wanted to cook the food that I loved for people.
And define the food at Luke's.
I always like when other people do that.
I hate that question too. That's what I'm asking you.
But it's I think the heart and soul of it is that sort of French country or Mediterranean country, rustic. All the produce is from local farmers, wood burning grill. So lots of, we use a lot of vegetables and fruits and olive oil and really hopefully great balance of acidity and texture and elevated comfort food.
Would you say it's California cuisine?
Yes. Yeah, I definitely would say it's California.
Which I think the affinity of California cuisine to Mediterranean food is so close. I mean, of the Mediterranean, of the sort of French and Italian Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. So you opened up, was it meant to have an ambitious wine program? Was it meant to be gunning for a certain audience?
We were cooking the food we loved and having, really wanted the service to feel welcoming and to just kind of create a delicious experience for people. We were definitely not trying to get a Michelin star or trying to have a Wine Spectator wine list. But I think we were, I had worked at Campanile for 2 years, so I knew kind of a lot of the foodie people in town. And Carol, it's funny because Carolyn and I, my business partner, who is now kind of an amazing wine expert, when we did the first wine list together, and we did it at her house, and we had our friend George, who was running the wine program at Campanile, he came over, and we brought like 50 bottles, and we would open, say, 10 Pinots, and we would pick our two favorites, and those were the two that went on the list. That was literally how we did our list. The one thing we knew is that we didn't want to put anything anybody knew, because I knew that if we put one Duckhorn or something on the list, it was like that's what everybody would order.
90%
so the
of
idea
the
was, yeah,
then.
The idea yeah. was just everything was kind of unknown, but we really picked it. That's how we did it. It was one page, and then that is just really.
And now, how many pages?
Oh, like 25 or something like that. It's in.
So Caroline Stein is Suzanne's business partner and is one of the most lauded wine people in America now. Talk about. The luck of having a great team and building something authentic. But it's always amazed me that, I think your success is great food, but the hospitality part of it is seemingly from the outsider perspective of mine been so important to the restaurants and that it matches the setting so well, that there's an ease and an authenticity and a comfort level coming from the service desk that's totally pro, but it's not encroaching.
Right.
And so
I'm glad that's what you feel, because that's the intention.
That's the intention, so you're killing it. But that kind of goes so far as to, I always ask like repeatedly in my head, the never-ending question is, what makes a restaurant great? A restaurant great?
I think part of it is that personal thing where that it's, instead of trying to be something or trying to guess what people want, I think if you approach things really authentically and you bring to it who you are and what you are and how you want things to be, that can really resonate with people because it's real. So I think that hospitality that I'm so glad that you're feeling comes from us, over the years really creating this crew and family of people who work for us, who are like-minded, who get what we're trying to do, who feel it the same way we do. And I think that culture, as that culture has built over 20 years, there's people that it works for and people that it doesn't. But as you keep surrounding yourself with more of those people who believe the same things you do, it just helps reinforce that culture more and more. And then that is, pervasive through the
system.
Through the kitchen, through the servers, through the how the room feels, through how the you know, servers approach the table.
I think it lessens the need for austere training on hospitality mm-hmm. and just relying on the vibe, mm-hmm. you know, the vibe that people project within the restaurants. But mm-hmm. it also, you know, 5 and 10, my first restaurant, really relies on this core group of waiters that have been there for so long that mm-hmm. they're not going to allow things to get out of sync.
Right.
There's kind of an innate peer pressure that
right. oh, definitely.
That works really yep. positively to affect everybody who's a new hire. You know, the nightly recaps are always like, oh, so-and-so started today, they'll make it, they'll do
right,
fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Or so-and-so started today, they're not going to be a good yep. fit, and yep. then they have to go.
Yeah. So I think it's also like having that... But having that that training, that austere training behind it, so you have like the bones of it, right? Just like in yeah, the kitchen, you have to have the technique and the skills and everything. But then you have, but then being like learning our style or learning the vibe or learning how. But I think if you to kind of have the skills and the knowledge, and you can kind of come like it's almost like the servers that have worked fancier places and then are happy to bring it down,
right?
You know, but yeah. they know how to do. Everything that needs to be done, you know, and they know how to kind of, but they can sort of relax and enjoy themselves at that point.
Yeah, I remember moving back to Athens to open up 5 and 10 from San Francisco, and I'd been working at Gary Danko, and I was like, I never want to do fine dining. Mm-hmm. So I had to kind of create this idea of how do I make moderately fine dining mm-hmm. casual in Athens, Georgia.
Right.
The most fanciest restaurant was Red Lobster at right. the time, which is still a pretty fancy restaurant. So, you know, it's like, but you can still bring everything the fine dining does to a place that you want people to come back to.
Yeah.
Multiple times. It's not just once a year thing.
Right.
And you seem to have created these places. I mean, the fanciest restaurant in your repertoire is Luke's, mm-hmm. but it's got the Sunday Supper series, which kind of makes everything, it resets everything to a very casual note every Sunday.
Yeah.
So explain what the Sunday Suppers is and why you started it.
So we've been doing Sunday Supper since we opened 20 years ago. And it's just one thing I loved, you know, traveling in France and reading about France and is just the idea of the prefix menu and not the idea of a tasting menu, but the idea of like a little brasserie where you go in and they say, oh, this is our 3-course menu for the day. This is what you're having.
Yep.
So it's, I like it on both sides. I like being the guest with that because I'm a Libra and it's really hard for me to make decisions sometimes. So I actually love the decision being made for me. This is what you're having. I love that experience of at being at the table and we're all eating the same thing.
Yeah.
But I also, and also from the chef perspective, it gives us a moment. You know, we change the menu probably 6 times a year, you know, mm-hmm. seasonally, and then sort of like one kind of like some mid-season changes. But this is, so Sunday's a chance to indulge something that I just feel like cooking in the moment. It's, or to, when cherries very first come into season, play around with them before I'm figuring out what I'm going to put on the menu with them. Or sometimes it's like we're feeling Moroccan or we're feeling
Is it sometimes served family style too to share?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Most of the time it's not, but we do sometimes, especially for special events. Usually it's one appetizer, choice of 2 main courses, and one dessert. And it can, the inspiration can come, sometimes the inspiration comes from the dessert. You know, there'll be a pastry chef wants to make something and we work backwards.
Right.
But it's just a fun, it's also, it's good because it pushes me because you know how it's
you
like,
have to change.
You got and yes, yeah, and it has to happen every Wednesday. I got to get it done. So it's
something new has to happen.
Yeah.
But and it's funny with the marketing things. I mean, as restaurateurs, sometimes when we want to get butts in seats, we throw every idea at the wall, mm-hmm. and some of them just don't stick. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because we didn't give it a chance. Maybe it's because it wasn't a good idea.
Yeah.
But this is one you guys have stuck with for so long, and it's been so successful. But I just love the idea of engaging the staff to reset to something new every week.
Yeah.
And it doesn't give you the drudgery of what Sundays sometimes is
yeah.
in restaurants, right. which is hell, fuck, I got to work
right.
brunch.
Right, exactly. Well, it's great for the cooks too, because they also, we do a smaller staff and everybody cooks their one dish start to finish.
Yep.
As opposed to, you know, usual where it's like some stuff done by the sous chefs and the prep cooks and
some doing entremets and they're building a plate. Really, this is start to finish and they can put their name on it and have a palpable like reaction to what they've done.
And it was not a hit from the beginning. It was actually a struggle. I mean, for the first 6 months, it was really hard to get. People used to, you know, when they would hear, so you don't have the full menu? And I always credit my sister she was our general manager at the time, mm-hmm. and she just really made it her mission to kind of turn people onto it and explain the good side of it and sort of spin. She's a great spin doctor.
But that's in the marketing has changed so much. How do you push that back in the day?
I mean,
postcards and something with your bill
word of mouth and talking.
And that's about it. Now it's, you know, get it up on social media and hope it hits and gets some reaction. Yeah. But, or, you know, you call your PR company, you know, whatever. Yeah. It doesn't. I don't need it in a magazine in 4 months. I need butts and seats this
now,
Sunday
exactly.
To pay the bills. So that's funny. There's in reading over some of the menus at the restaurants, there's always you write menus in ways that are so so simple is always a weird word.
Yeah.
Simple to most people outside of the restaurant world implies easy. Mm-hmm. And simple to me in the restaurant world is one of the most difficult things to pull off.
I agree.
Like, how do you evoke something that's so pure and simple and technically driven?
Mm-hmm.
But you've got like Richard Olney's white bean puree on the Luke's menu, which to me sort of goes to a beautiful simplicity that's so, like, it takes me to a place because I've read Olney so much.
Mm-hmm.
So Richard Olney was from Ohio, went to France relatively young and never came back.
Yeah.
Wrote all the Time Life books,
mm-hmm.
And wrote amazing book on Romani Conti. He lived in a little basic hut with a big wine cellar.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care.
Yeah.
His kitchen was pretty much outside.
Yeah.
But tell me why that puree is on the menu and walk me through how it's made and why it's great and why it stands out to you.
Yeah, I think he's one of those heroes to me and somebody that I've whose books I read early and kind of I went into that fantasy world of that idea of that dedication. I also love, I can never serve room temperature asparagus because I always think he has this dissertation in one of his books about, you know, people who you grill asparagus and serve it and how it, you know, and I actually agree with him. Kind of it gets that, it leaches the liquid and gets, but it's funny because he's such a rule master almost in a way, or just a tastemaker, and also like
he's very opinionated.
Yeah, very opinionated. The ways to do things, and you didn't want to do it not the way.
He was the opinionated gay hobbit
exactly,
of France.
Exactly. Right. So that puree just is, you know, I can actually see the book that it's in, and it's a simple puree of white root vegetables. So if we just do turnips and celery root and parsnip, and you just do it really lightly in butter, and you let it just cook with its own juices and puree it. That's it.
Yep.
And I didn't want to steal it from him, but I also kind of wanted to have
a
little nod to him, you know, kind of to say.
Cooking is so copied, though.
Yeah.
But that I think that's a really important and a. I think we need to name check our mentors more and often, and make sure their legacies live on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're doing. Is it at here at AOC that you're doing the Zuni chicken?
Zuni chicken,
which is such a seminal recipe and deserves to be in our technical craft of cooking for the next 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't. It's an amazing recipe.
Yeah.
It's amazingly written recipe. Mm-hmm. So this is Judy Rogers, who was the chef and owner of Zuni Cafe in San Francisco, still a seminal restaurant. Judy passes away, but before that, she'd written an amazing book. And this book is perhaps one of the best cookbooks written in the last 25 years. The opening section about her history and where she was and working with the Trois Gros.
Yeah.
But it's also a book I point to young chefs to be like, if you don't understand the meticulousness of the notes she took starting at age 12 on cooking in a Trois Gros kitchen, that set her apart from the rest.
Right.
She documented everything. Mm-hmm. But to have that dish on the menu here, to me, is another like mark to your mentors.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you know, you're not forgotten.
Yeah.
This dish is amazing.
Yeah.
And it gives us narrative and it equips the staff to have a story to tell at the table.
Yeah.
Does it sell well?
It sells great. Yeah, it sells really well. And it's actually, ours is different. It's not exactly her recipe.
No, you've got like shaved
fennel.
It's
like a riff. Yeah, it's like a riff on it.
Again,
it's for me, it was a combination of, you know, definitely that was the inspiration for it. And I'd rather call out the inspiration than, you know, pretend it's mine.
Yeah.
And I, like you said, it does. I like keeping those names alive. I like people, you know, to think that everyone who comes into Luke and reads the menu is like, so who's Richard Only? Like, who is that? You know?
Yeah, I started writing a big list for a new project I'm working on books I would like the front and the back of the house staff all to read. Mm-hmm. And it suddenly became like 200 books. But
I can't come to work today. I'm busy.
I need to winnow it down. it was Richard Olney. It was Judy Rogers. It was all those people. It was a lot of even nonfiction books that have nothing to do with food and wine, just about how to be a better human. And I think that perception from a restaurateur and chef standpoint has changed so much in the last 5 years on wellness and the idea of wellness within the kitchens and taking care of our own. And
right, they used to be a...
Yeah. I mean, you've got a... It used to be like, just get the most you can out of them and they check out and you've forgotten who they are and they show up the next day and you hope that they're alive.
Yeah.
And those days are way behind us because, you know, with a lack of the number of people in the labor market to hire, we have to figure out places or create places that people want to be every day pay them commensurately. But you've got a 3% surcharge on the menu.
Yes.
Explain that.
We do. So it's a healthcare surcharge. So it helps us to cover our health insurance for our staff.
And it has an opt-out kind of clause on it written on the menu. If you don't agree with it, you can ask for it to be taken off.
Exactly.
Has anybody ever asked for it to be taken off?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So you do get those people in here.
We do.
Well, and they're welcome back. But
yes.
by good wine. We'll pay for
you know
it
the
some
hard
other
thing?
Way.
I think one thing, and this is maybe like too much dirty laundry, but I think if we think about how the restaurant business has evolved, it's based on a system that is going to have to change at some point in terms of labor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we have minimum wage here. It's $15. It's almost $15 now. It's going to be $15 by 2020, which we are all for paying the kitchen. Everybody should make more than that. I agree.
Right.
The problem with California is that it's also that also applies to service staff, to tipped employees. So, and
tipped employees make $15 an hour
plus their tips.
Do you get a tip credit here?
We get
on your taxes?
We get tax tip credit, but we don't get any. It doesn't count towards their minimum wage.
Right.
So you can't say, oh, but they make $200 a night. They're making more than the $15 an hour.
Waiters
so
in Georgia are still paid $2.12
exactly,
an hour.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, to bring them up, you know, with their tip wage over.
Right. But because it was because the system was built that way, restaurants have such a huge labor. We just need so much labor. It's a very labor heavy business, and it's really hard to do it. So we've all gotten used to doing it that way, but now it's getting where it's really hard to afford to do it that way. And so what do you do? Is that when you go to like a 20% service charge? Is that when you go to, do you raise your prices? There's also, I think as a business owner, you only want to raise your, you want to raise your prices so you can cover your costs and make a little profit, but you don't want to price yourself out of the market.
No,
so
I mean,
it's a really tricky time, especially in California with the minimum wage, and for that reason, like I said, if it was minimum wage, period, you know, and we could count the tips towards it, that would be fine.
But yeah, basically, Suzanne and I and all their chef restaurateurs in this country are constantly worried about. There are three factors in restaurants overall. One is your nut on what it costs to occupy the building and the space, mm-hmm. and includes the utilities. The other one is your cost of goods sold, which is the amount you pay for something as a percentage of whether you're later going to sell it for. And the third is labor. And the one thing that's malleable in that is cost of goods sold, but we can't just jack up everything on the menu to mm-hmm. eke out some profit. The other thing that always irks me about our industry is that there's an assumption looking around this beautiful room with all the expensive wines in it that we make, 25% profit or 50% like a law firm would.
Right.
And yeah, that week. Wouldn't that be awesome?
It'd be really great.
Man, those trips to France would be gilded.
Exactly.
But we don't. We eke out. Somewhere, depending on who you are and where you are, 3-10% maybe.
Yeah.
And, you could get more money in the bond market often than running a restaurant. But we do it because we have a passion for it and we love it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an expression of ourselves, but it's getting increasingly difficult.
It's hard, yeah.
I don't even want to. I mean, do you guys own real estate of any of the restaurants?
We own Luke. We own the building at Luke.
Okay.
Yeah.
Smart buy.
Yes.
Which actually gets to a really interesting thing is what business moves do you regret not making, or what sort of parallel business decisions on starting new stuff do you regret not doing?
I don't think it's anything I regret.
Not regrets.
Right.
Or what do you see lost opportunities? I think I should have opened up a fancy ice business, right. Yeah, because exactly. I think I'd be really there retired on a really nice beach, right, with big cubes of beautiful clear ice.
Yeah. Right.
Before mixology became a term, if you had caught that time.
Yeah, time, right? And done the, yeah. I don't know. How about a POS system?
They, yeah,
get a POS system. I feel like every time we get a new POS system, I'm like, why don't we have somebody who knows how to...
Yeah,
how and that works.
Or, you know, reserve, resi and all those things, stuff. And open table and... But it's amazing, you know, the business used to be in a lot of ways so simple, but now it's even like home finances. It's like you have no idea how many costs we now pay for cell phones and subscriptions to, you know, TV services or internet services and all these things. There's a tangential to the restaurant business that we just have so many more costs, mm-hmm, than ever before that it's hard to figure them all out, yeah, and how we get rid of some of them. But I mean, the reservation services seem like a no-brainer now, but they're super expensive, yep, for us to, mm-hmm, to maintain.
Yeah.
And then we're always wondering, you know, is there an equitable cost of PR and things like that? Do we need that?
Yep.
We all get lots of play in magazines.
I just want to cook, right?
Yeah, I don't want to worry about all that stuff. But we still have to worry about that stuff.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, definitely that's the skill that you have to just keep working on how to manage all that, you know, how to make all that work. I think I don't have any missed opportunities, like things that I wished I'd, you know, oh, I should have taken that, like we should have gotten that space or I should have done that. I think I'm very like happy with how things are. I feel very lucky that we opened our first place 20 years ago, you know, and that we were in that time when I think things were easier. It was easier to, you know, our rent was $5,000 a month, and our we were able to, you know, the minimum wage thing was not such an issue. I feel like the whole litigious situation had not gotten so out of control,
right?
You know,
between
that you were
developers and landlords,
yeah, or no, or just people, you know, somebody, people, whether it's real or things that people concoct, you know, like the people suing us for not, you know, that they didn't get their meal break that we,
right,
told them to take and had them punch out, and then they actually went and didn't punch out so that they could, you know, because somebody told them, like, hey, if you do this, you know,
yeah,
this whole...
But in that litigious world, I mean, there's some stuff that came up in the last 10 years that was heavily litigated in the courts around restaurants that were good things,
yes,
I think. I mean, there's some overemphasis, and
yeah,
there's some too much of a push on some of those things. But, you know, shift pay...
Yeah.
Shift pay in industry parlance is you would, if you were working at a restaurant in New York 12 years ago, you'd get paid $600 for your week.
Right.
Well, what they didn't tell you is it's not really based on a 40-hour week.
Right,
it's based on you got to get your work,
yeah,
done.
Yeah. So it's,
and if
like
that means coming in,
yes,
yeah, yeah, at 10 and leaving, yeah, at 2 in the morning,
right,
that's what it means.
Yep.
And, you know, and it became a really exploitive way of,
yeah,
of getting people to work. So that was heavily legislated against and litigated against, and it really no longer exists because,
yeah,
of it. So, you know, the exploitive nature of an industry is going away in some ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, now there's the Me Too movement, which is calling a lot of people who have definitely crossed the line. And but, you know, some of which, you know, it's hard to see people you once respected go,
mm-hmm,
down in flames like
crazy
that.
Yeah.
But it has to happen,
yeah,
at the same time, you know, I've got three older sisters and daughters and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I don't live in this world to condone that sort of thing. So in this, when we're curating a restaurant and when we're being at the forefront of farmers in our locality, how do you continue to buy from them? Are there still trips from AOC to the farmers market, or is it, are they all delivering to you?
It's a combination. We still go every Wednesday and every Saturday.
Which, to the Santa Monica farmers
market? Santa Monica, yeah.
Okay.
Wednesday and Saturday. We do Sunday in Hollywood sometimes,
okay,
depending on where we are with, you know, what we need.
Yep.
But a couple of them do deliver. There's also a company a produce company here called LA Specialty.
Okay.
And they shop the market too.
Okay.
So you can, in a pinch, get something from them if you
want to pay that premium.
If you didn't, you know. But we try to really do it on those twice a week trips, and then a couple farmers that do deliver.
And the beauty of seasonality in California is, you guys are in the amazing bread basket of vegetables and fruits and things like that. Like, looking at the menus, it's like you're talking about, you know, one of the menu lines was the last of the citrus, mm-hmm. which that's just for this year, people. They're right. Florida's
having
some big problems with citrus, so it may be the last of the citrus for good there. But
From our peeps.
Yeah, last from your peeps. But so right now, we're taping this in mid-May. What are you most excited for, like, produce-wise? What's coming up?
Cherries, which are right now. Yeah. Apricots, which are almost here. I'm looking forward to summer. Stuff, you know, some summer stuff comes early here, almost for me, sometimes too early. It's like we can.
Yeah, I don't want tomatoes in June.
I don't want it too early. Yeah, tomatoes won't come, but we'll get corn really early. We'll get summer squash. Yeah, August. Yeah. And we actually are like October is like our prime.
Wow. Tomato. We're too hot. I mean, Georgia burns up and then gets cooler by October. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, August, early September is tomato time for us, and then it goes away. What farm has most amazed you in the last 5 years?
Oh, well.
Individual farm, like which one that you like, wow, when they show up question. At the door, you're like, wow, that is so cool.
You know what? That is, it's a hard to pick the favorites there, but I would say Coleman Farm.
Yeah.
They do so much. They're always kind of looking for sort of new, interesting greens and herbs and roots and flowers. And
that's interesting is that I think we've seen this, like, I always call it the sort of, third rail or third line or whatever it is. It's like we think a topic is exhausted. We think that the idea of organics and the panoply of different choices are exhausted, but then people do more research into it and find this apple or this pluette or this apricot.
Right.
And suddenly they bring it in and it's just something totally different.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, we're able to rejuvenate excitement within our menus based on people trying out new things and continually doing it.
Definitely.
So they grow a lot of greens?
A lot of greens and a lot of herbs and sort of like kind of lesser known, interesting herbs. And another one would be Wiser Farm, because they're doing something called the Tehachapi Grain Project. So he's working on, you know, bringing this actually to Hatchby.
Which is amazing. It's actually in conjunction with a Southern guy.
Yes.
Who is Anson Mills,
yep.
Who's Glenn Roberts.
Yep.
If you ever talk to Glenn Roberts, he's an encyclopedia of grain everywhere. But it is amazing to, and that's a really cool project.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Really cool.
And so when we talk about like the future of food, doesn't have to be Soylent and Impossible Burgers. The future of food can be like the best wheat grown in this project in California and how it's processed and milled to retain integral whole grain. So it's, to me, that's the interesting side of food. So with changing on protein fronts, you're seeing a good seasonality there. What's in season right now? When is Dungeness season?
Dungeness is now.
Is now.
Yeah.
Okay. And spot and prawns.
Spot prawns. You know, spot. It's so funny in terms of this seasonality. I feel like they're always around.
Yeah, more and more so.
They just, it's just, you know, pricing and availability. And it's funny. It's hard. Things like spot prawns, which I love and are such a, you know, they're crazy.
They're
expensive.
Really expensive.
They're so expensive. That we kind of have to do.
And it's funny that they're so expensive because shrimp kind of do it like bunnies.
Yeah,
They're out there.
Yeah.
It's not going, we need to talk it's to not these a non-sustainable
these
thing.
These Santa Barbara shrimp need to get
and sea urchin. Sea urchin is like the bane of the ocean.
Right.
And yet we pay so much for it.
Right.
I'm always like, why? It's so abundant.
It's
but
all
I guess
being shipped
diving
away,
for
I guess
it is
diving. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It's like crazy, dangerous, weird. So how is the balance between all of this in restaurants and creation and cooking and then balancing family? You've got three kids. You've been enormously successful. You're one of the top chefs in your field. And I have my own balance to it. I've got two girls and it's it's hard to make the call on when you succeed, are you allowed to separate a little bit more from the restaurants and let them go, or should you be in there butchering and curing things and teaching new technique to people?
Yeah, there's a lot of guilt involved, I think.
I don't think we should feel that way.
Yeah, I do feel it though.
Well, yeah, naturally.
I feel it. I feel it both ways. I feel, you know, like when you're not one place, you feel it about the other place. I think in this moment right now, my kids are so 12 and 10. So they want us home all the time.
You got that 12 because they're 12, twins.
12, there's twins, yeah. 12, 10. They really want us home. They want help with their homework. They want, and I think, I feel like that time maybe, I feel like that time's fleeting, you know? And, you know, in a couple of years, when they're going to become grumpy teenagers and not want us around, or I don't know. So I skew that way right now when I can.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually trying to work more daytime and then with nights speckled in, as opposed to I used to work like all day, all night, or I used to kind of start more like maybe a little later in the day and then always work night.
But I think that's tied into the wellness of ourselves.
Yep.
It's not just our people. It's like, I don't think you're going to get to retirement age and bemoan the choices you made in limiting the time.
That I went home and had dinner with my kids.
Yeah.
Better history test. No, I know.
You know, you can't. I mean, and you're, that doesn't make you any less of a chef.
Right.
It actually, I think, makes you a smarter chef.
Right.
I think it makes you more applicable and able when you're here, knowing that you're covering all your bases in leadership at home of a family and leadership within the restaurant. Yeah. And I think it's showing example to them that this is a beautiful space and a wonderful restaurant. It can't exist without you being here every moment of every day.
I mean, you know, it also brings up, you know, it definitely empowers the people under you, like Adam Cherney, who's our chef here. You know, he does an amazing job, and he's really great at helping, you know, at bringing the cooks up and bringing, because that's the part too, is I feel like the restaurants are so personal.
Yeah.
And part of the personal part is me, right? So I have to kind of, like, I want them to, you know, I want to have interaction. I want to be teaching. I want to be doing that stuff. It's just, how do you do it? And I think this is where the multiple restaurant thing makes it hard too, because it's like you got to spread your.
You're spread. Yeah,
You're spread thin. But I have really, I mean, it's a cliche, but it's true. I have great people underneath me who help me do that. And I kind of try to read when I need to interject myself more than less. And part of it's being a control freak and learning to relinquish control and to be okay that maybe it's not going to be done exactly the same way you would do it. And
you know, I found when you have one restaurant, you can concentrate on it with your whole heart and be there all the time and do it. And it really is a cult of your own personality. When you have two, you're kind of frantically running between the two. When you have three, you can begin to not disappear. You can disappear into your own world and do your other things. And when you have four, they you're never anywhere because you're at a place far, far too little to really have an impact. But it's funny that you mentioned that your personality is so attached to the restaurant, and it is, and that's the most difficult thing to explain to people when you begin to need to step away. Mm-hmm. It's the most difficult thing to teach is how do you teach authenticity of personality and zeal? Right. Zeal is hard to teach. You don't write down zeal. It's a natural thing about hospitality, and we have it, or some people have it and some people don't.
Right.
But the other thing that we talked about before we really started rolling this was AOC was opened up in another location and then moved more than 10 years later to this location. And I talked briefly about that there's a hidden something between the customer and the restaurateur about why they love a place.
Right.
And sometimes you can't quite put your finger on it. And when you move, you risk upending the cart.
Yeah,
and clamoring for something that you still can't put your finger on, on what was the mystique about the old place that everybody loved. Mm-hmm. It just worked.
Yeah.
But I don't think that, I think that happened in reverse here. I think the old Luke's, from what you said, was more industrial space, more contemporary. But this is the French farmhouse of your dreams. Yeah. This is AOC.
We all say that was our starter house. This is our big girl house.
It is a big girl house. But it also just evokes I mean, AOC stands for Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, the AOC system of France, right?
Mm-hmm.
This evokes that. I mean, yeah. You're in here. You're in like a wine barn.
Way more than the original place did, which is interesting.
But tell me about like the decision and you're very successful at the old space. What triggered the want to move?
We were coming up on our 10-year anniversary. So, and you know, it's like a 10-year-old restaurant it's not easy.
It's about to have to be reinvested in to be a new restaurant again, because the 10 years, it's all broken down.
Yeah, and people, you know, I think there's such a fascination with, like, the new and what's hot and where to go. And so we were in that moment sort of like and so it was a very urban-feeling place. And I think, you know, Luke we joke because all of our restaurants have patios with trees, which is funny. Not even, like, consciously. It just is. That's, I think, part of what feels good to me. We didn't have an outdoor space there. The neighborhood was a little bit shifting, and so we were looking into doing a renovation where we would maybe sort of blow out the front and put a patio in the front. And in the middle of all that, Carolyn ran into an old boss of hers who actually had bought this building. And he had done a restaurant here. His name's Sean McPherson. He has a lot of... Now he does a bunch of hotels in New York. He's a very busy guy. Had moved his focus more to New York. And he had done a restaurant here, and he was sort of like, I don't know, would you guys ever want that space? And I've known this space my whole life. And Carolyn, too. She used to come here with her dad when she was a little... It used to be Joe Allen.
The restaurant was called Joe Allen.
It's one in New York.
What kind of restaurant?
Also. Oh, it's like a very mover and shaker.
Steakhouse.
Kind of like steakhouse-y.
Power lunch. Five martinis.
Yes, exactly. And so... We both.
We want to bring that culture back.
We do need to bring that back.
It's kind of key to our bottom line. You guys should be drinking more at lunch.
Drink more martinis at lunch. And so when the idea of the space being available, it was like the timing was too good. It's like, okay, because no matter what we had done to that other space, we could have never made it as great as this space. I mean, this has the bones.
Well, the funny thing about this space is in the fact that it's been many other restaurants is it's made to be what you guys are doing here.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, you walk in the door and into the beautiful room downstairs, and it's just, it's exactly what I associate with your personality, your food, Carolyn's wine, name.
Yeah.
It's just the magic puzzle fit together, which in upending a restaurant, moving it is really rare.
Yes.
But so much credit to you guys for beating that sort of what can be a really difficult hurdle to get over and making it better than it ever has been.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we do better with it's sort of funny. It's a little bit like how I would rather cook the food that's given to like the produce. I'd rather have somebody say like this, okay, here's what's in season. You need to cook with this rather than like pick up the phone and order anything you want in the universe. I actually love, and Luke was this way too. I love, you know, it was a beautiful, cool, old, rustic space that we made into something, but we had to work around. Like, next time you're at Luke, if you look at our fireplace, there's like a side of it that's like brick and crumbling and falling apart, and we just left it because I didn't know. I was like, basically, anything we're going to do to fix that is not going to be as cool as what it is now. There's like these weird cutout windows that don't, they're like not symmetrical.
But you need to look at that as patina.
Yeah, it is. But I
everybody
actually,
wants patina.
I actually really, I love that. And I actually, even here when we took over, you know, we changed some things, but I like having those boundaries of, if the boundaries are good, you know, I like having those old bones that were working, like there's a column in the wrong place. Like, okay, we're going to work around
we'll
it.
We'll work around it,
you know, rather than
the
like,
cost to move it is $45,000 and what's the point on that?
Exactly.
And it's actually a structural beam and we'll have to get engineers involved.
But I like all
The quirks that make
the
it right.
The quirks and the little bit, I don't know, messy, like lived in.
There's a
patina,
depth to it. Architectural depth to it that's rare. And you guys have two kitchens. There's one upstairs and one downstairs.
Yeah.
So how do those function?
The downstairs kitchen is the kitchen that we execute the meals out of. The upstairs is really just a prep kitchen.
Okay.
When we first took over, we thought that we would use, because it's a little mini line up here, thought we would use this kitchen
to service this room, which is this. We're in an upstairs private dining
room. It's a private dining room, but it's also, we use it for,
overflow.
If there's no parties, we seat up here.
Yeah.
So it's basically always either a party or either a buyout or a regular service. But again, actually, it's kind of like a labor model thing. It's like, wait, so I'm going to bring in a whole nother crew to serve these 40 people when I already have a crew downstairs to serve the other 200 people.
Yeah, let's like, figure this out. It's not going
to
be that hard.
I'd rather
hard.
Put like an extra person down there to help
to
make
help
the whole
run.
Thing
yeah.
happen.
Yeah.
And that way, too, we can kind of be prepping upstairs, too, while service is going on. And we were joking, actually, at Luke. I was talking to our general manager. You know, last night we have this little ice cream freezer, like the wheel came off it or something. So, of course, we have like a little Cambro container shoved under it.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, the metal
like.
Six pan inverted. Exactly. It's a perfect exactly. height of the fridge wheel.
Exactly. We were joking about, you know, people sometimes ask like, wow, 20-year-old restaurant, how did you do it? I was like, it's like a lot of jerry rigging and mm-hmm. like corner cutting, you know, not on the food, but on the, you got to.
No, you don't.
You
got to
make it work.
That,
you
but,
can't
you
like
know.
You don't have to. You don't. You can't call up and order a $3,000 freezer. You got to like figure out how to you know make that work.
I remember putting somebody through refrigeration school who was a line cook just so they could have sure, those skill sets.
Okay. That's genius.
It's great. Yes. Yeah. It's a good asset to have.
We have a food runner who's our handyman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
which
he's
is
all,
great.
Yeah. He's like our delivery guy. He's like does everything.
And that's what you need is somebody. A lot of people wearing many hats to run a restaurant. Because, you know, I always people ask me, what is a restaurant, like, what's the work like on a day-to-day basis? I'm like, it's kind of like an ER of hospitality.
Totally.
It's triage. It's like you have a list, and every day you have to get through the list with the same smile on your face and the same zeal and want to do it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's dire and, like, the dish machine is broken or the actual human dishwasher got arrested or whatever. Yeah. And the other times it's like the problems are trivial and small and you just tick them off the list and you go about your day and you start service and it purrs.
Yeah.
And it's great. But it's triage.
And it's almost like, let's say I come in, it's like, okay, do Sunday menu, you know, put the new cherry salad on, do so-and-so's review or whatever. And it's like, and then you add the 10 things that happened while you were sitting there trying to do that list.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Yeah, people as leaders in restaurants and as chefs, I started a campaign about 20 years ago to save time in my life by telling people they were not allowed to approach me with, "Can I ask you a question?"
Yeah,
they just should ask the question because if I add it all up,
the
all the time they
what
say,
"What about can I talk to you later?"
Yeah, can I?
No,
you
can
talk
to me
now,
right now,
and
I don't
want to
be worrying about
it,
how you're going to quit for the next 8 hours.
Yeah, so it's like communication is so interesting in restaurants and how we do it, and then while you're expediting, if something's brought back to you and it's not right, it's like I really don't need a long explanation on what's wrong with the pivot to or. I just need to know what's going to fix the situation right then and right now. And the faster you tell me
that, the faster I can do
I can do it for you because I'm really out to make you happy as well.
Yeah. We just said that we're training this. We're the Hollywood Bowl season is just ramping up, and we were training the staff over there. And my example is always like, and I know this sounds really obvious, but every year something's like, I don't need to know where they're from. I don't need to know why they want it cooked more.
Yep.
Like, I don't need to know that it's their anniversary. Yep. All I need to know is, can you make this steak?
I don't need to know that they're grumpy or had trouble parking.
Right.
I don't need to know any of that because everybody's somebody and they're all different in a restaurant.
So
our job is just to make them happy.
Yeah. You have to be careful in real life because sometimes I think it makes you, like, you're just
very direct.
You're just direct because that's what you,
that's
how we get through the thing. It's like you have to remember sometimes people like, aren't used to that or something.
Yeah, I think the traits of restaurateurs and chefs when they get out in the normal world can sometimes be spotted really easily.
Yeah.
Like in a crowded bathroom, I'm usually the guy tamping down the towels in the in the bin.
Behind you, and the grocery store behind you.
Yeah, which is
really weird.
It's really weird. It's like, I'm like, emotionally, all the way, behind you. I'm trying to think about the best meals I've had in the last few years. And, you know, best meals, let's preface this by saying a best meal, and I think Suzanne's probably going to thoroughly agree, has a lot to do with you as a diner.
Yeah.
It's got a lot to do with the want to have an enjoyable meal. It's got a lot to do with the situation that you went through during the day or who you're dining with or how at ease you are with the situation. And that doesn't mean the food's secondary. But I was with a couple of friends and I was guest chefing on James Beard Cruise, which was interesting. It was a lot of fun.
Did you go somewhere good?
Yeah, we went from Dublin all the way down to Lisbon, along the coast
that
of France.
Great.
But in we went into we stayed in Bordeaux for a couple of days, and when it drove, we rented a car and drove up to Saint-Emilion. Went to this place, this little hole in the wall called L'Enclos de l'Enfer. And you go in, and it's just a regular on the main square in Saint-Emilion, and walk through this kind of basic restaurant, but they've got a huge patio in the back that's beautiful. Like, it actually looks a lot like all your tree-lined patios with all your herb pots and things like this. And, you know, sat down, ordered a $22 bottle of, it was a Sommelier de Champigny, it wasn't even a Bordeaux, and a braised lamb dish. And it was like lamb dish for a crowd type of thing. Wow. And it was a huge shank, slowly, slowly cooked, and just with this almost like North African shermoula type spice sauce on it. And it was so good. Yeah. But it was just like the perfect temperate day. And it was great company. And it was a great wine that had like 20 years of age on it, but it was like 25 euros. It's like dirt cheap, but it was like awesome. And so everything plays into that. And it was so good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, do you have a... And getting specific, you know, the worst question you can ever ask a chef, as you know, is, what do you like to cook?
Right, exactly.
I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Everything? I don't know. Give me good food. We'll cook it.
Yeah.
So give me an example of a dish. You can even have made it in the last 2 years. They were just like, it's so simple and so great, but it was just, it was the confluence of the time and the place and the people and you being at ease. It made it great.
I think the one that always comes to my head is actually in, we were in Toronto, David. It was actually more than a couple years ago. And I was on.
That's my home.
Book. Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Well, I'm from Ottawa, but yeah.
I was on a book tour for AOC.
Mm-hmm.
And it was January.
Yeah.
In Toronto.
That's cool.
And yeah. And I'm from here.
Toronto's slushy, though. It's not like frozen tundra.
I don't know. We were, and I love to walk. And so we always, wherever we go, and people are always like, oh, it's cold. You guys go, yeah, we're going to be fine.
We'll be fine.
Oh, no. Toronto was like one block. And I'm like, okay.
But where's the cab?
To Bar Isabel.
Oh, yeah.
And we had the octopus, you know, that comes, like the whole octopus, like with the knife in it. And again, it was that thing. Like it had been freezing cold. We'd like fought our way there. I think we didn't really have a good restaurant list, but we went. Somebody had told us one bar, and we went there, and the bartender gave us a list of his favorite places, and then that was on there. So we just kind of like found it. You know, when you find, as opposed to like having all this hype, you just sort of find this place, and we walked in, and we're like, okay, we are with our people
and,
now.
And you know, I mean, everybody always asks me for where I should eat, but yeah, Bar Isabel is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, took over it. So Bar Isabel is a guy named Grant Van Gemeren, who's a chef in Toronto. He took over an old Portuguese restaurant and he opened up his Bar Isabel. That's Portuguese food. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's great.
It's so good.
But it's so, but like, the, I, like, they didn't you, even like, change much in
like
there.
Like you said, the server, I mean, it was just, we had a great server who was not, I mean, again, I have no idea what his professional skill level, I mean, but more like the personality, just like a great personality. He was basically sort of like our host. We had stumbled into this place. It was freezing cold. We were drinking great wine, ordered this octopus. It came to the table, and I just, the drama of it with the knife.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I'm sold.
But that's, you know, that Bar Isabel has what AOC has. It has what, you know, what we love about the Joe Beef restaurants is there's palpable authenticity.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's like, it shouldn't be that hard, but it's the hardest thing to attain in the restaurant business is when you walk into a place as a customer, immediately you are either turned on or turned off.
Yeah.
And when you're turned on, you're like, man, everybody seems to be happy in here who works here. It smells great. It
smells good,
It looks great. They're taking care of the little stuff. Everything's kind of efficient, but they're excited.
Yeah. It's actually like a self-confidence without an arrogance.
Yeah.
You know, like the restaurant is comfortable in its own skin. It's like a person who's comfortable in their own skin.
But
and,
yeah.
You know?
But it's not arrogant.
But not arrogant.
It's just like they're so cool and they don't even know it.
Exactly.
You know, that's the best feeling in a restaurant. But it's the hardest one to mimic too. Los Angeles is a really interesting place to me. And I've spent a lot of time here. And I think the days of people... for lack of a better term, shitting on LA as being a crappy city of long since passed.
Right.
Because to me, it's like one of the best eating cities out there.
Yeah,
I mean, so there's just everything's here. Mm-hmm. And but the funny thing about LA is, and obviously there are some really high end restaurants, but I don't think LA really loves fancy high end all that much.
No.
So how has the scene changed in the last 20 years here?
Well, it's funny when we. So I grew up here. So I went.
Luke is 21 years old.
Luke is 21 years old.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy.
It doesn't even have a fake ID anymore. Yeah. It's got a real ID. Did you take the restaurant out for a drink?
Yeah, we took her for a big drink.
Okay, good. She deserves it.
A couple magnums of champagne.
Yeah.
She was happy. So when we, but it's funny, when we opened Luke, it was sort of Expago, Campanile, Valentino.
Valentino.
Like Patina.
Wow, yeah.
Patina. It was definitely an era of a little bit more fancy, high-end. Again, I mean, Spago has always been like, it's like LA's version of fancy, you know what I mean? But spectacle kind of thing a little bit. And we were sort of like, we were like the girls. That's what everybody used to call us, like the girls. And I think when we were opening, it was hard for people to kind of get a handle on what we were trying to do, because we were actually sort of, we were not fancy. We wanted to have great food and it to feel like a special experience when you were there, but not to feel fancy and to feel like you were coming into our house. And
yeah.
Which at the time I think was,
you wanted to
was different, you know.
Curate accessibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without knowing that was the words of what we were trying to
do. Yeah, yeah. I can only actually put words on them after.
I remember preaching to the, you know, to hosts when we were, or even, you know, like to our managers when people came in, because it was sort of the era of the anorexic supermodel hostess who always treated you like shit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like that we didn't want that. That we, and you'd sort of had to tell people, like, we want actually, we,
if
want,
you're
we
somehow
want you to be nice to people.
If you were somehow responsible for ending that era, thank you.
I don't know. I don't even know if it's over, but.
In some iterations, I don't think it is. Have you been to Las Vegas? I don't know if it's over.
But just that idea that of there didn't have to be a pretense, didn't have to be a. And I think that people would say, well, so is it fine dining? And I finally would say, well, it's fine dining, but in a sort of more casual atmosphere, because I felt like if you didn't say fine dining, that meant, I mean, fine dining was sort of code word for, like, is it sophisticated food or is it good food?
Or do I have to wear a suit or whatever?
Yeah, I don't even know. But it was.
I mean, the response should always be, it's just good food.
Good food, yeah.
That's it.
So I feel like we were on the cusp of that. You know, it hadn't all changed like that yet. Like, there wasn't The Hungry Cat and Animal and Tuamet, like these places that are like in mini malls or in like odd locations you wouldn't expect, or more sort of night market. I mean, like the idea that, you know, you take over part of your parents' Thai place and, you know,
but I love
your own
night
more
market.
Casual thing. I mean, it's like, but that all happens in LA. I think I think it's part of the, and I think it's spread everywhere now, but I think that's the LA, you know, we're the new city, we're the new kid, we're the goofball, we're the one everybody makes fun of, we're the one where you can kind of take a risk and really, I think, do something that's meaningful to you. And
I think LA is expressing individual personalities and restaurants better than anywhere else.
Yeah,
anywhere else. Sure. And I don't, you know, and I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great city to go and eat at. You can still spend like $500 on sushi for one person,
for sure.
Which is really painful, but good. But who knows?
I think it used to be very, also like geographically, it used to be, even when we were opening Luke, it was like you needed to stay within certain boundaries.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, actually, I remember when Nancy was opening Moza. Like that was risky.
Yeah.
Highland. I mean, actually, where Patina was kind of like
the old Patina or the new one?
The old Patina, like where Providence is now.
Right.
Like used to be, that was edgy.
Yeah.
You know, to be like that far east on, you know, and it's so funny how now it's like, you know, be in the valley, you can be in a mini mall.
Yeah, you can
West
anywhere.
Adams. I mean, West Adams is booming.
Yeah.
Like you would have never, I mean, never mind all this sort of downtown stuff. It's like, it's just different than you could have.
But, you know, I think as a weird barometer, I mean, obviously it's just a list, but just the Best Chef West category this year was just this amazingly mixed bag of a truly astoundingly talented chefs. Yeah. Michael Zemiristi won it, but Jessica Koslow was there, you know, on the ballot. It was just like this amazingly interesting grouping of people, which really typified that it used to be so concentrated around Northern California and San Francisco and Sonoma and Napa and Berkeley that now it's really a lot about L.A., which is cool. Yeah.
I remember for years the nominations of the five, there would always be one Southern California.
Yep.
Sometimes none.
And now it's like four out of five.
Yes, four out of five.
Yeah. which was amazing, yeah. And a credit to a town. But but it's more of a credit to what I think you and Caroline have wrought here and curated here and the food you've cooked without changing and kowtowing to trends. And, you know, I always equate it to, in fast food, do you want to be a place that serves one or two things really well, or do you want to be like a McDonald's that every year seems to change the menu and add 50 things to try and get some market share? It's like, you guys have taken pride in the footprint that you've created over the years and continue to do it with diligence and quality and technique and hospitality that in the end makes you better than everyone else. So it's good. Well, we're going to wrap it up. I think one line that you said, which I think you should repeat to yourself every day because I think it's great. You said, I am very happy with how things are.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing. It's like we should always be happy with
how things are.
How things are.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yes.
Right.
I keep saying, chanting that to myself.
I'm going to,
when I'm
too.
Not happy with how things are, I'm going to tell
myself.
It's like
that little redheaded girl on the YouTube video says, I love my dad. I love my sisters. That was viral a number of years ago. But Suzanne, thanks a lot for having
me
here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Great.
Thanks for coming.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Cheers.
I taped this week's episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on location at AOC in West Hollywood. You should definitely go there. Scott Porch produces the show. Mackenzie Mizell edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, rate and review, and come back on Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Hugh Atchison. Thanks for listening. Eat well. Be swell.